I'm John, he's Patrick. Together we're the functional nerds. I'm John, he's Patrick. Together we're the functional nerds. Together we're the functional nerds.
My name is Patrick Hester. His name is John Anilio, and you're listening to The Functional Nerds. This is going to be episode number 240.
240. Wow. That is Patrick. He is an author, a blogger, and a Hugo award-winning podcaster for the SF Signal podcast. You can check out his website, atfmb.com, and follow him on Twitter at atfmb. My name is John Anilio. I am a musician and a podcaster. You can check out my website, johnanilio.com, and you can follow me on Twitter at johnanilio, and you can check out our website, functionallearns.com. And Patrick, how are you doing this week?
I'm doing pretty good. How about you?
I am just fine. Things are going good here. Working on some new compositions, just plugging along, getting ready to start the summer. So that's all good. And hopefully we'll kind of keep moving ahead with some good shows and getting some different guests on and maybe doing some other kind of cool, interesting things moving ahead. But yeah.
And a couple of weeks ago, we talked about how you're recording in a different room. You're recording in your in-laws' house.
I am.
And in the background, there is a singing fish, one of those fish that's on the plaques, and you push the button, and then it starts moving and singing. I just want to throw it out there that my mom loves that shit.
Mm-hmm.
And when she had to move into my house, one of the things that I actually did was I banned all of that. And I did it after Christmas because when Christmas rolled around, suddenly I had the rocking grandma,
oh,
which
is
the grandma in the rocking chair.
Yes.
And I had like a Rudolph thing. There was a Elvis Santa thing, and there were all these things, and they all made noise. And I was like, okay, I'm done.
Mm-hmm.
No more of that crap. It was just driving me up a wall.
Yeah, I think she got that for her retirement a few years ago. So there you
go. They were cute, and I remember when they were going around, and it's like now I think they're available usually at like tourist stops along the highways, the major highways, like if you're taking the north route or the south route, and like I-40 or whatever, and you stop at certain places, you can get those. I think there's one that if you're in Winslow, Arizona, and you pull off, there's like a fish you can get that sings the song from the Eagles and all that kind of crap. So,
yeah, very good. All right, let's get on to our picture.
We're just a strange culture and people, aren't we, John?
Absolutely. All right, well, let's get on to our picks of the week.
Picks of the week.
And I'll go first. My pick this week is Dollhouse. Been watching that on Netflix. That's been in my queue for however long it's been on Netflix, which has been quite a few years, I think. I feel like it was on there, and then it came off for a while, and then it was back on there. And it was one of those, it's Whedon, I'll get around to watching it eventually. And I tweeted in Facebook because, I've been sort of watching a lot of current shows through Hulu. So I was watching Arrow, and I was watching The Flash, and I was watching S.H.I.E.L.D. And I finished watching all of those, and I finished season 2 of Orphan Black, and I wanted to get started. So I sort of tweeted and Facebooked out like, what should I watch next? And I had a couple of choices, including Dollhouse, and the unanimous winner from the three choices I gave was Dollhouse. And the conceit that people gave me was that, it's rocky at first, and boy, were they right. I almost gave up on it in the beginning. I got to like, so the first two episodes, I was like, all right, it's the first two episodes, cool. And I got to the third episode, and I'm like, oh man, I don't know if I can keep going with this one. Like, the third episode is the one where she's like the backup singer for, I don't know if you've seen it,
yeah,
Patrick.
I've seen it, I watched it live when it was on.
Yeah, so when I was watching that one, I'm like, I don't think I can do this. Like, I just don't think this is really my thing. And I'm like, you know what? I'm going to keep going, because I sort of had the same experience with Farscape, where I found Farscape difficult to get through the first bunch of episodes. And someone was like, skip the first bunch, go to episode 6. That's where it starts getting good. That's where they kind of let Whedon do what he wanted to do, and then it gets much better. And I think you still have to – I'm someone that's like, I'm not going to skip episodes. I'm going to watch them anyway. And like, you know, I was going to give it that first season at least. And it gets great, like right around midway through the first season. And it's so good. That second half of the first season, I just started season two. So I haven't even gotten through season two yet, but the improvement in the second half of the first season is astronomical. And I think it's just really cool. Like it seems like in that second half, there's a big kind of shocking reveal about certain characters. Like with every, it's like, oh, and you thought you knew this character. Well, guess what they do. And you thought you knew this one, but guess what about that? And it doesn't seem forced or anything. It just seemed like, when you sort of look back to the beginning of the story, to the end of that first season, you're like, oh yeah, that makes sense. But you're like, I'm surprised I didn't figure that out on my own, but I had no idea. So it's, you know, sort of your typical Whedon. And one of the reasons why I was interested in watching it too, is that you start seeing, I always kind of enjoy this. You start seeing actors that are alumni sort of show up in different things. And because I mentioned I watched S.H.I.E.L.D. and Agent Carter, so the, I can't think of her character's name on S.H.I.E.L.D., like Zhaying or something.
Dyken Locken.
Yeah. So I was like, oh, I think she was on Dollhouse. Yep. And the guy that plays Victor on Dollhouse was in Agent Peggy Carter. And he was one of the agents. And so when I sort of started seeing, I'm like, well, that's cool. Like, I kind of like seeing, you know, and it's sort of like, it seems like with Whedon, he has like his favorite actors and they tend to show up in a lot of his stuff. So it's kind of cool. If you haven't watched Dollhouse, but you've sort of been watching all this other stuff, it is cool to see all these familiar faces and even like guest stars. I just watched an episode where it was Apollo from Battlestar Galactica in it, and Hilo is in the whole series.
Yep.
So it's cool. And the first bunch of episodes are hard to get through. I will say that. And if you're someone that has no patience, you probably could skip them and probably start at about episode 5 or 6, but it's great. I really like it. So
yeah, I want to talk about this for a second because you are correct. He does like to bring, if he finds someone that he truly enjoys working with, he tries to work with them more and bring them through. And so I don't know if it's Dyken or Dickin, or something like that. Locken is the lady that you're talking about, the actress who was first in Dollhouse, and yes, has recently been in Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. And I won't spoil who she was. He tends to do that. Like you can also find on Netflix his Midsummer's Night.
Oh, Much Ado About Nothing.
Much Ado About Nothing. Thank you. Yes.
I'm planning on watching that when I'm done with Dollhouse because I'm like, oh, that seems like a lot of the same actors too. I bet that's cool.
Yeah. And so you will see stuff like that show up. Goran Vizhnagar was on Agent Carter. And yeah, so he does like to pull those through and kind of do different things with them. One of the things I don't know if you're aware of, we're recording this in June, but in May, we actually hit the 10th anniversary of the last episode of Buffy the Vampire Slayer. And it's interesting when you talk about him reusing character or reusing actors. Sarah Michelle Gellar has always been incredibly kind to the fans of Buffy the Vampire Slayer, but has also like drawn the line and said, you know, I did that. I've been there, done that. I'm not going back kind of stuff. Right. So, but she is, like I said, she's incredibly kind to the fans, and anyone who says anything to her about Buffy, she will just light up and she will have a conversation with that fan. And, you know, she loves that stuff. And so she's very aware of the fan love for the characters in the show and all that kind of stuff. But like I said, she's also drawn the line. I thought it was great that when the 10th anniversary came up, she was tweeting about it like crazy.
That's cool.
So you know that still holds a place in her heart. But she's one of the actresses I've noticed that has not worked with Joss Whedon again.
Yeah, I was thinking about that because you do see them bump up, you know, and it's not like she, I mean, she's still worked.
Oh, but yeah,
it's not,
she does all kinds of stuff, yeah.
Yeah, but it's not like she became an A-list actress either. So I'm sure if she wanted to do some stuff with Whedon, and we didn't wanted her, I'm sure you would see her pop up. So I wonder if there's like maybe they burned out on each other or something, you know, that kind of happens too.
And that could be because one of the things that she's talked about is being the main character on the show, the named character on the show, she was involved so much on every level with that show. Mm-hmm. And that's why there's no commentary on the DVDs from hers, because when other people were recording the commentary, you know, she was working on the actual show and doing stuff. Mm-hmm. So that's one of the reasons why she, but like Faith, for example, has been in a lot of things that Whedon's done.
Mm-hmm.
So, Summer Glau.
Yeah.
You know, Summer, a lot of different things. So.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, Eliza Dushku is like the producer on Dollhouse. I think it was like their project. I think they wanted to do something together. And I think that was kind of where it was.
She had a deal with Fox at the time.
Okay.
And they kept trying to find the right show for her. Dollhouse was one. The other one was the one where she was the, she worked in, was it the coroner's office or something? And she kept getting the flashes of like the dead people or something. Yeah, there was something like that. So yeah, there was a couple different projects that she tried to get off the ground with Fox.
Yeah. Well, you know, what I find so compelling about watching Dollhouse is, it's so weird. It's really weird. It's like a really, it's well written. It's such an original idea for, I'm surprised it aired at all. Mm-hmm. Like, it just doesn't seem like something you can sell to the public all that well. It's like, cause it's like, who's good and who's bad? Like, I don't even know what's going on. It's so bizarre. And I can't think of who it is, cause I know I stopped it, but the music, the score is great, cause it's so creepy. Mm-hmm. It's so like ominous, and it's really, I don't know. It's really well done. The music, but that's my pick. So what is your pick, Patrick?
Well, and just throw it out there real quick. Fox does a lot of stuff like that. They will do different things. And then, like you said, it doesn't necessarily find an audience and they cancel it. So they get a lot of shit for canceling these science fiction shows. Unfortunately, the science fiction shows end up not being able to find a strong enough audience to keep them going.
Well, you know what? It's kind of interesting about Dollhouse is like, I remember when that was, I didn't watch it when it aired initially, but like, I don't remember our community loving it at the time. Honestly, I don't remember an overwhelming support for it at the time. I remember actually quite a lot of criticism if I recall. So it's funny how these things sort of take on a life after the fact. Cause I don't remember a lot of people, you know, being big advocates for the show when it was, I'm sure there were, but I don't remember that being as popular as other shows that got canceled. So,
right.
So, yeah.
I understood.
Yeah. All right. What's your pick, Patrick?
We were talking a little bit about The Expanse, mm-hmm. and we were talking about the new show on the channel formerly known as Sci-Fi, mm-hmm. and how when that launches, which they still have not given a premiere date as far as I've been aware of. Mm-hmm. It just keeps saying 2015. So, who knows, you know, when that show is going to launch. I keep kind of watching for it. But we you and I don't remember when we said this, it was easily 2-3 weeks ago, we were talking about how when that show comes on, it'll probably be the only show I'm watching on that channel.
Mm-hmm.
Well, mm-hmm. I have a DVR.
Uh-huh.
And I have the Hapa.
Mm-hmm.
And with the Hapa, you can set up, you know, to record all these different shows and everything. And so I have a ton of things set up. And sometimes I'll hit my DVR button to watch something, and there'll be something that's in there that I'd completely forgotten about that I even still had a record thing set up for timer. So Defiant Season 3 has just launched.
Oh.
And I didn't even know there was going to be a season 3. I thought I thought it had been canceled.
Yeah, I thought so too.
But apparently they've just launched Defiance season 3. So that is my pick, because that is it's an interesting show to me. Mm-hmm. And I've called it in the past Eureka with Aliens, because it's, you know, the cop and the daughter come to the little town and stay, you know, mm-hmm. and then it's the monster of the week kind of stuff. And I don't know. I don't want to spoil season 2, but
because I haven't watched it yet.
Season 2 ended with some stuff that felt final to me.
Okay.
That's why I thought that, like, maybe they had gotten the note that, you know, we're not going to do a season 3, so you better wrap some shit up.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently that didn't happen. So yeah. Season 3 just launched. And again, cool. I don't want to give away spoilers, but I'm like, holy crap.
Yeah. That's interesting, because that was one of the – because I watched season one when I still had cable. I was DVRing it and I liked it. And I just, season two just went up on Amazon Prime, if you have that, or went up a couple weeks ago, at least anyway. And that was one of my sort of choices when I sort of tweeted it out there. I'm like, should I watch Dollhouse or Defiance? And Dollhouse won, but I'm going to get to Defiance because I did watch season mm-hmm. one and I do want to watch season two. But yeah, I really thought that was it. Because I haven't heard anything about it. Like they haven't, I mean, I don't have cable anymore, so I wouldn't have seen a commercial anyway, but I'm just surprised that, you know, I don't remember seeing anything on like IO9 or Tor. You know, usually they would sort of hype that up a little bit, but it's weird.
I know. And if it weren't for my DVR timer, I was completely unaware that this show was coming. Mm-hmm. So, and that's interesting because I'm also on the publicist's list for that channel. So they do send me stuff occasionally. And I don't remember seeing anything about Defiance season three. So it's just tripping me out. As a side note, the day that we're recording this on a Saturday, and the BBC America is launching their new show, The Adventures of Norrell and...
Oh, yeah, I know what you're talking. It's based on that book, which yeah. I have that book, but I haven't read it yet. Jonathan Norrell.
Jonathan Dr. Strange and... Dr.
Something
Norrell?
With normal. Yes, I know what you're talking about.
Yeah.
So I'm sure fans of that book are like, you idiots.
I know, right? You know this
book? Aren't you guys hooked up to the internet? Can't you look that up before you butcher it? God damn you guys.
But that's launching on BBC America. So I actually did send up my DVR to start recording that series as well. So I'm hoping that that's going to be good. And then if you're just looking for recommendations, I got a huge recommendation from Dave Gross on Penny Dreadful.
Yeah, heard that's good. And so much stuff, yeah.
The reason I haven't watched it is it's on Showtime. I don't have Showtime. You know, it's one of those things. And Showtime never comes to Netflix. You have to go elsewhere to get Showtime.
Well, now Showtime has its own streaming channel now, too. But you got to pay $11 a month. And I don't think they have enough content to really justify that.
They've got a lot of shows, dude. They've got Shameless. They've got the
it's true.
The one with the guy who's the fixer in L.A. and works for all the Hollywood people and covers up their crap. Ray Donovan. I've heard nothing but good stuff about that. And then now this one, and I think they've got some other ones. It's like, I don't know if it's worth $11 a month.
Well, what's cool about that stuff is that it's pretty easy from what I understand to sign up and to cancel. So you can sign up and have it for a month or two, watch whatever show you want, and then cancel it if you want, which I suspect it's not on there yet, or maybe as the time of this airs, it might be. But once HBO Now comes to Roku, it has a right now it's has an exclusive with Apple TV,
right,
for the streaming players. But I think that's only for 3 months. So I suspect in July at some point, or maybe August, you will see it go to all the other streaming boxes. I can't believe it won't go to the Roku player. Roku has everything. So I'd really be surprised if they didn't. So once that goes there, even though it's $15 a month, I will get it even whether I can. Well, just because I've only watched like the first three seasons of Game of Thrones, and I've watched them on DVD, taken them out of the library.
Game of Thrones, I have a couple years ago, to be honest with you.
Yeah, well, either way, the reason why is because if I bought all those episodes for a season, it'd be like $30-$40 to buy them all, like on Google Play or something. So even if I just get it HBO for a month or two in the summer, I could watch all of season four and season five and you know, just cancel when I'm done. And if I like the other stuff, maybe I'll keep it. But
And then at that point, you can watch True Detective. You can watch True Blood. You could watch Rome. You know, all these shows that were on HBO.
Yeah. Some of that stuff is on Amazon, but it's not the most recent seasons. And plus, I think you get all the movies that are showing at the time. And I'm Silicon Valley. I watched two episodes of that on the plane coming home from Capricorn, and I really liked that. So that's something that you'd get too. So there's a lot there. But
well, I would like to thank everybody for listening to this episode of Cord Killers. I'm really sorry that Tom Merritt was not able to join us for this episode.
That's why I was on that show, because I do think about that stuff a lot, you know. But anyway. All right. So, Patrick, who do we have on the show this week?
This is our last interview from the Pikes Peak Writers Conference. And if you're not familiar with the Pikes Peak Writers Conference, I do suggest you look it up. It's a wonderful writers conference that happens every April in Colorado Springs, Colorado. So it's not that far from me. If you are anywhere in the country and you're a writer and you're looking to learn how to write, or you just want to buy me a bear claw, please, by all means, you know, sign up for the Pikes Peak Writers Conference. Fly into Colorado Springs. I'll come down. You can buy me food. It's a wonderful experience. And I guess you can learn some shit, too. I don't know. And this is a New York Times bestselling author. He's got a ton of books out there. And he was the very first person to co-write a book with James Patterson. His name is Andrew Gross. And he was a wonderful interview for me. We talked about a lot of different stuff, but he wrote like five or six books with Patterson and kind of got that whole thing started, you know, the back and forth thing. And I mean, we talk about being an author, John, and we talk about like the overnight success of, you know, it's like you have 10 years worth of work that goes into your overnight success kind of stuff. Imagine your overnight success is you are on the New York Times bestseller list with your first book. That's kind of crazy, right?
Absolutely. Yeah.
And so, and then every subsequent book.
Mm-hmm.
So he has this really cool path that he took where, you know, he got rejected. He was unemployed. He had no money. He wasn't sure how he was going to pay his bills. And then his phone rings and this guy says, "Hey, James Patterson got your manuscript that just got rejected and he liked some stuff in it and he would like to talk to you. Is that something you'd be willing to do?"
Mm-hmm.
Sure.
Yeah.
Right. So, and then, you know, he did that for a little while and he credits Patterson with kind of teaching him a lot about how to structure and become an outliner and be able to write books that people want to read. And during that whole process, he still had these ideas for his own stuff that he wanted to do. And to his credit, you know, he wrote it and he took it and he was able to get his own stuff published. And then those started hitting the New York Times bestseller list too.
Sure.
So it was just a really, really fun interview with him. And I hope people like it.
Cool.
And I'm sitting here at the Pikes Peak Writers Conference 2015 in Colorado Springs, Colorado, with Andrew Gross, and I'm hoping I'm pronouncing everything correctly.
So far.
Awesome. Who is a New York Times best-selling author who is a keynote here this year. Mm-hmm. And Andrew, why don't you tell people a little bit about yourself?
Well, I'm a thriller writer. I write suspense novels, page-turners. I've started out by writing five with Jim Patterson.
You get to call him Jim.
I do get to call him Jim. Well, he goes by Jim, just like I go by Andy. but you know, I stumbled on him. Maybe we'll talk about that in the time we have. Mm-hmm. But all of them went to number one. Then I started doing my own things. I've had 9 thrillers. They've all sort of hit the list in some way, but nowhere near quite where I was with Jim. But better to be on than be off. And my last book, One Mile Under, it takes place in Colorado. It's actually sort of split between the Roaring Fork River area because it has a lot of whitewater thrills outside Aspen, but mostly up near the Wattenberg oil field outside of Greeley in the drought-stricken, petroleum-heavy area that's now undergoing a lot of fracking and things like that. And it just was released by HarperCollins 2 weeks ago. Doing great, and so that brings me here.
Well, happy book day.
Thank you. 2 weeks belated, but that's
is it still just like an absolute thrill and exciting when that's coming?
Well, here's the truth. Not to discourage anybody, I'm someone who always wanted to write one novel. I'm now on my 16th. And it's hard for me to even say that because I still feel a bit like a rookie. I like to feel that way, but, you know, it's 16 years, which in fact is the longest I've ever done anything in my life. So I guess I've arrived as a writer. In that time, things definitely have moved along from where each book was a privilege and was really part of the sort of thrill, you know, you were talking about, So now it's a business. It's a career. It's an obligation. So, you know, when you're writing, you never try to lose that innate thrill that comes with being a writer. And there are various parts of it, but when you get out on the road and a book is out, no, I don't know that I have the same thrill I had at the beginning of it. You know, I you know, the touring is probably less a factor than it was. And by touring, I really mean putting myself in front of my fans, which is a great thing, except, you know, I guess behaviorally people aren't coming out the way they once did, and these tours aren't nearly as important as they once were. And the truth is, we always have the highest expectations for the books, and no matter how well they sell, they're always a little bit of a disappointment, at least to me, in terms of whatever I'm hoping we'll see them. So my happiest points come when I'm working on the project as opposed to selling the project.
That's interesting. Yeah, was it lunch a couple days ago?
Lunch yesterday is when I gave a little talk.
The days start to blur together mm-hmm. as you get little and little, less sleep. So you told some great stories, and you mentioned the James Patterson story. He's become this huge brand.
Mm-hmm.
And now I see they're also doing the same thing with Tom Clancy now. Tom Clancy is a brand, and I don't know if
there's several people in terms of that, and yeah. several of them are having their best years after they died.
Right? That's kind of strange.
Yeah. Well.
So I'm assuming that some of the books coming out in the Clancy line, probably Tom never actually had anything to do with.
I suspect that's the case. That's not the case, as far as I know, with Patterson. Mm-hmm. One, he's alive, and two, he's quite active and in control of his projects.
Hasn't he been on Castle?
I think so. Okay. I haven't been. Everybody
well,
always says, you should be on Castle. You even look like the guy. You know? I've never even watched it, actually.
Oh, really? It's fun.
Yeah, it's fun.
Yeah. In the beginning, when he was first starting to work with the police, he would have the other writers.
Right,
would
a
have
poker,
the poker
game or something. Yeah. I've always heard about him.
Yeah. That was kind
somehow
of
my television doesn't turn to ABC. I don't know why. It's just not our channel of choice. So, you know, how it doesn't turn to Fox either, by the way, but... And we're not supposed to talk about that.
Well, Fox canceled Firefly, so screw them. So you had the opportunity to work with James Patterson, basically because you had submitted a book.
Yeah, I spent the first 15 or 17 years of my life in business. I worked for a large apparel firm, a diversified apparel firm. It was a $1 billion firm, and I ended up being on the board of that, and then I ended up outside of that firm, but doing some turnaround projects in the sports clothing business, like Head, for instance, Head Tennis, Head Ski, and a couple of other companies. But ultimately, I wanted to, life conspired against me. I actually just came home without a job one day, and I like a lot of people have, had on my bucket list, I had a novel I wanted to write. I'd always written, and written in college with some success. I'd actually published before I got to college. But you know, this career interceded, but finally, I just sort of was totally burned out and really didn't want to put any more blood on the playing field. So I just came home and told my wife, I know this is going to sound strange, but I've always wanted to write one, and I'm going to write a novel. And, you know, as I said the other day, my wife is a 20-year yoga teacher, so I know that self-actualization was really high on her priorities, so I knew I had that sale made. You know, I didn't have to sell too hard. And, you know, without going on too long about it, I think anybody out there who's an aspiring writer knows it doesn't take a year to write and publish a book. It takes a year maybe to put the words on paper, and which it did for me. It took a year to polish those words and so I could market them, and took a third year of trying to sell it. So 3 years with no income, 3 years drifting further from whatever it is that I did that would be revenue generating, and 3 years where I was sort of joking yesterday, all the people who were patting me on the back 3 years before for such a romantic and brave decision were now rolling their eyes and probably asking my wife what the so-and-so was Andy doing with his life. And I finally put this book together. I actually attracted a top agent in New York. You know, he gave me sort of every sense, and he's still a top agent, that this thing was sort of giving buzz on the street, and it was going to be an easy sell, and, you know, go away for a couple of weeks and you're going to have a book sold. But it didn't sell. And I got about 25 rejections. And the truth is, I had zero idea what my next step was in life. I really... All I could think about was how I'd spent 3 years on one project. That project was now out the door. There was no one else to send it to. And I basically taken my kids from having a, you know, high flying trajectory in life to just sort of nothing, you know, and out of the blue, I got a call from James Patterson. Well, actually, out of the blue, I got a call from someone who said, "Can you take a call from James Patterson?" As it turned out, he was looking to hook up with someone. He had an idea for a series. It was for female crime fighters. It eventually became set in San Francisco. It hadn't been set yet. And he called it his idea for the Women's Murder Club. And he was looking for someone to hook up with. And the manuscript that was sent to him by the then president of his publisher, AOL Books, Warner Books, wrote on the cover, "This guy does women well." which I think meant that I wrote them well. So he read it and got my number and called me up out of the blue. I live in Westchester, north of New York, and he had a house there too. And we met for breakfast. He threw his ideas past me. I had no plan B, right? So, you know, all I was doing is sort of saying, this is the way that I'm going to elbow my way inside the circle. This is mm-hmm. like a gift from God. And what I think readers should think of is Jim Patterson, this is 15 years ago, Jim Patterson 15 or 16 years ago was not the sort of branded subject of Harvard Case Review author that he is today. He didn't have this stream of number ones behind him, literally like 8-10 a year. In fact, to my knowledge, he didn't have one. But he did have two extremely well-selling and maybe still his two best books, Kiss the Girls and Along Came a Spider, and I'd never read a word of his. But we met for breakfast, and he threw these ideas out at me, and I sucked them in and went home and wrote two chapters as I thought this book he mapped out should start. And the best thing I can say is that it's become the second best-selling crime series in America after his first best-selling Alex Cross series.
That's awesome.
Yeah. So it was a lot of good luck. I guess I brought something to the table, and that it was my manuscript that was acted upon. But clearly it was just sort of a case of good fortune falling on me. I mean, the truth is, one, they rejected it for whatever reasons, but they thought enough of it to say, you know, you ought to talk to this guy. Two, he read it and acted on it. So it worked out, and I ended up doing a bunch of books with him before I went out on my own.
We've done interviews with people before who have collaborated on projects. There is a married couple who writes a series for Pyre and how they work. I've had Kevin J. Anderson on talking about, collaborating with Brian Herbert. Yeah, on the Dune books. Mm-hmm. And everybody seems to have their own way of doing that, especially it can be interesting when you have people with egos and that kind of stuff. How did the process work?
One, keeping in mind that I haven't worked with him in 10 years. Sure. Two, he is still going strong at it. I was actually his first co-author, so we were both feeling each other out. The interesting thing was that no one really knew how to organize a contract because it hadn't really been done before, at least by him, so it was sort of interesting how we got to that point because I sort of really had a whole lot of say in how I was compensated. Today, I think it's a little more of a boilerplate thing because he has, eight or nine people working in that stable. But I don't know. I suspect that Jim is never very open about that process, but what I will say is that every book I did with him came from his idea. And a lot of people have this cynical view that all he does is slap his name and someone sends him a book. He likes it, he slaps his name on it, he makes a few million bucks and, the other person makes 100,000. No, not true at all. Every book I did came from his idea, and he's a strong believer in outlining, which I am sort of a real proponent of as well if you're writing plot-intensive stories.
You talked about that yesterday.
I'm actually doing one at Thriller Fest, which is a large thriller convention in New York, and my subject is outlining. I'm a strong believer in it, especially for people starting out. It's one thing, I'm now on book 16, and, I still outline. As a matter of fact, I just switched publishers from HarperCollins to St. Martin's on a book that's now in work in process, And I didn't sell a book. I sold an outline, which, by the way, is extremely rare in fiction. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I do have a track record, and my outlines read like a novel. Their chapters are outlined all the way through. But anyway, I sort of learned it from Jim, and he would present me with one. And so, you know, I guess it was my job to flesh out the outline a little more into a full story. And I could think you can assume that when someone's name is big and someone's name is small, that the someone small might be doing a lot of the work of writing the book. But Jim also always had last draft. And I'm a strong believer. I sort of say that it's almost like polo, like Ralph Lauren, is that if you walk into a polo store around the world, it all has the signatures and feel of like a flagship, you know, wherever. Mm-hmm. And down to the nth degree. And if you read a Patterson novel, not that I've read one recently myself, they still sound like they're all written by him. Sure. So he does have a last draft, and he does go after you. And so anyway, you know, that's sort of how they did. They all ended up at number one. So when I wanted at some point to go off on my own, it gave me a great platform to have bestseller status with my publisher, as opposed to most people. You know, the irony, of course, is that if I had published my first book, Hydra, which was a political conspiracy novel, and if I had ever really gotten that published, which would have made me about the happiest person on the planet, I probably would have printed 5,000 or 10,000 copies of it. And the likelihood is it would have sort of disappeared from view. And I think I would have said to myself at that point, this is what there is. This is what it's about. And if not only for economic reasons, just said, I wanted to do it. I did it. I'll just go find a way back into business in some way.
Sure.
But it didn't sell. It led me to Patterson. And when I went on my own, I had a much bigger platform. You know, I had 1 million people who were reading my books. And the last 3 books we did, my name was equal billing. So I had enough of a sort of platform to my first book, The Blue Zone, ended up number 10 on the New York Times list and got sold to about 25 countries. So most people don't debut that way. You know? And I sort of use the analogy that I never went to, you know, A ball, B ball, or triple A. I just sort of got thrown into the majors, which is both good and bad. I mean, I'm happy it happened that way, but there were also things I missed along the way and that I wish I had had a more stable, you know, root up, as opposed to getting thrown into the big boy pool.
Sure. You know? And you told a story yesterday about you did these books with Patterson, but you started to have your own ideas again that you wanted to work on, and then you started working on an outline, and then you sold that book.
Yeah, so I've sold 2 from Outlines, which sort of belies, you know, the experience, but they're thorough, and I sort of want to get that point across. It's not like I put a few bullet points on a piece of paper and go in there and say, you know, here's my book. I sold it yesterday. I won't go through it on the air, how I sort of went to a dinner party and met this objectionable couple who, as we got back in the car, we said, you know, never have to see those people again, phew. And as it turned out, a month later, I'm reading the Times in the morning, and there's this very same guy who's been arrested for money laundering to the Colombians. And
you turned to your wife and you said...
I turned to my wife and said, I told you he was a schmuck. Because she liked him a little. I said, see? Right again.
Yes. You know?
But what really sort of hit me in it is how you sort of get to the heart of these stories is that, you know, he was kind of a larger-than-life figure. He had a lot of dough and was a member in Westchester of some, you know, fairly ritzy clubs and business organizations and was very well known. And he had a family sort of the same ages of mine. I think my daughter was, at that point, maybe 20, 21. Maybe she was in college. I don't remember. But all I could think about in his case was, How must his kids feel, you know, knowing that their entire life has been a lie? So
right.
So that's what I was sort of tapping into, is this sense of betrayal between a father and a daughter, and that's what led to The Blue Zone, where there's a similar situation where someone has to go into the witness protection program. So it's the kind of books I write where I sort of put everyday people in peril, or at least pull the rug out from under their lives, usually through some mistake that they make themselves. So, you know, there is a flaw somewhere. A wife goes into a hotel room with a man that she knows she shouldn't, and even if it doesn't lead to anything, somehow the situation does, and, you know, catastrophe follows or something. That's sort of my milieu up until the book I'm writing, where I have changed gears. But the book that I have out just 2 weeks ago actually takes place here in Colorado. It's all set here. And
well, tell us a little bit about it. I mean, what's
going on? It's called One Mile Under, which is now a cocktail at the bar at the Marriott, and I'm not sure anybody would really want to drink something called One Mile Under.
Well, that's interesting, and I'll just throw it out there for our listeners that every year Pikes Peak Writers, Paco at the bar, designs and develops specific drinks for each keynote. So yours is One Mile Under.
Yeah, you know, I don't remember what it is. It's just full of rum and a bunch of sweet stuff that I don't drink. To me, it's a hangover before you even finish the drink. You know, aptly named though. And so it's a story of basically it's sort of a David and Goliath story of farmers and ranchers in Colorado that are displaced from their way of life. And a town that had sold its soul to the devil to survive, the devil in this case being a rogue oil company, and the Goliath being this oil company, and basically they want to reclaim their soul. It's kind of a modern day Western, and they turn to a hero that I use from time to time, a guy named Ty Houck, who's used to be a cop in Greenwich, Connecticut, and is really sort of a white knight figure and a bit of a troubleshooter, and he gets involved in this situation, and it's, like I said, it's kind of a modern-day Western of this Western town trying to take its soul back.
What made you decide to set something in Colorado?
I guess it's just how the story evolved. I knew I wanted to bring this hero of mine back in a book, and I read an article, again in the Times, about the bidding up of water rights in the drought-stricken areas, like kind of near the Wattenberg Field, this oil-rich field up, you know, I don't know what you would call it, not the northern plains, I don't think it's quite the eastern plains, you know, but where all the oil is and all the fracking is being done. And that, you know, these companies that need vast amounts of water for fracking are bidding up the price of oil to the point where these indigenous farmers and ranchers who've been there for 100 years are being displaced from their way of life. And to me, it was, you know, I thrive on these sort of conspiratorial situations because they're the delivery system of suspense for me. So I liked it. And I tapped into something else that maybe 17 years ago, I took my family. We used to do this a bunch, whitewater rafting, in this case down the Snake River outside of Jackson Hole. And I met this really sort of cool, pretty, well-cut, you know, like self-reliant, you know, a fearless gal who was the guide on our boat. And, you know, in all this sort of class four water, so it was pretty hairy stuff. My kids were freaked out, you know. But here's this gal that obviously she does it every day. But to me, I probably like had an instant crush on her, you know. But I always wanted to put her in a book, but I never found the way. But this was the perfect vehicle to do it because there's a murder that takes place at the beginning that happens on the rapids. And my character, who is a whitewater rafting guide, comes across it. And it, while it also is a person that she knows and knows that there's no way that he could have lost it at this stage of the rapids. He was just too good for it. And whereas everyone else is putting it off to an accident, she sort of irrepressibly keeps following the clues that only she as an expert knows and starts to discover that they're burying up the fact that this was a murder. And that even the sheriff of Aspen, who in fact was her old stepfather, who she had some unfinished business with in that sense, had a reason to be sort of putting it under the rug. And where it leads is what I said into the oil country, into the drought country.
Yeah, I'm sitting here going, yep, New York Times best-selling author. Because it's like, wow, man, you hit all these notes, and it's just, and you're,
well, come on, thank you.
You know, I'm bowing, man. That's good stuff.
Well, thanks. You know, it's a rich book, and do we have a couple of minutes left?
Absolutely.
You know, this is my ninth book, not including the one that Patterson that has never been published.
Sure.
And I've sort of decided it. And this book is a good example of it because it has a very rich sense of place because it's set here. I'm an Easterner. You know, I come out to Colorado a lot. I feel like I know the area, you know, and I can write about it. But it has a real intrinsic sense of place where a lot of my books are either taking place in, you know, where all the Jews are, so to speak, in Florida and New York. And it's always like a doctor who this or a stock, you know, a hedge fund manager. And that happens to him. So this one has a very rich sense of place. And I really want to sort of switch in my career to books that really that have a lot more resonance, not so much of character but of affirmation to them, and so and place. So the book I'm working on is a historical, and I think I'm going to continue in that vein. It takes place in World War II, about smuggling Jews out of occupied territory, and it's called, at least provisionally, The One Man. And the one man in this case is a scientist who can change the course of the war, and they want him for the Manhattan Project, the U.S. government.
Oh.
And in order to get him out, they send in a Pole who escaped 6 months before the war started, really, for just as the war... actually, in this case, it's after the occupation, who escaped and has to go back to the place where his family was murdered, and then has to be snuck inside Auschwitz to get this guy out.
Wow.
And so it really is sort of, I mean, there's a lot of sort of deep themes of grief and
sure.
the Holocaust a little. I've tried not to, I'm not trying to make it too barbaric, because one, it's not what I do, and two, people have done that already and probably done it better than I can do. But it really is a story of heroism and story of someone who... there's some things happen to this guy when he's there. He actually, I won't give too much away, but he has to make some choices once he's in there of what's important to him, his own family or fulfilling this mission. So
again, you're taking the everyday person and you're making them
into a hero too. Yeah. And it's funny, I've outlined the book, but I have three endings. And I sort of have a real clear sense of where I'm ending up. But in this case, when it comes to the survival at the end of it, I can go in the way I started out to think I would, which was a story of grief and someone who is unable to... He saves the one person, but not the person that he wants to save. Or something with a little more affirmation. And so I have these two ways it can end, at least. Maybe it's even three. And I'm not going to decide until I'm getting close to that chapter. I'm in over 300 pages, how it ends until I get there, you know, and whether I want to end it with a bit more affirmation or whether I want it to be, you know, a little sort of a Schindler's List, perhaps, or that sort of thing.
Well, now, what made you decide to shift into... this and doing like
I just want I think I want to write books that I want to read, you know.
Okay.
And
what do you
and,
like to read?
Well, I like to read rich. I do like to read historicals. I do read in my genre, of course everyone does, but I probably have some gaping holes in it. But I read whatever is out there and sort of breakout books. I mean, World War II has become like such a topical thing again. And, you know, I make a joke because I came out of the apparel business how I'm afraid 70 years later I'm going to miss World War II by 6 months, you know, and it sort of will be like cashmere in the bottom floor of I don't know what's out here anymore, Dillard's, you know, it's like you should have been here the last season, you would have gotten it, because even right now you've got a book called, really, really worthy books called All the Light You Cannot See, which is atop the bestseller list. You've got another one called The Nightingale, which is another really beautiful, resonant, not a thriller necessarily, World War II book. You know, you've got movies that are coming out left and right every year in World War II.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I mean, I've been reading a lot of Alan First. I don't know if any of your readers would know him, but he's a really rich sort of literary thriller writer that focuses on World War II before the United States got involved. So it takes place in Europe, and it's all sort of in 38, 39, and, you know, his characters are... you know, a Portuguese businessman that gets lured into a deal with the Nazis, or, you know, a reporter, and, you know, and so they're all these sort of atmospherically rich, you know, World War II novels. And so, you know, what I was really interested in on this is that my father-in-law is 95, and he actually left Poland 6 months before the war in 39.
Wow.
His entire family was killed in the war. He doesn't have any clue to this day what happened to any of them. And he's still so traumatized that he has never spoken to his own family, to my wife or my wife's brother, about one generation older than him. They know nothing about life in Poland. They know nothing about his family, is, you know. And when I even try to get him to talk, he just won't talk. He's just paralyzed. So I sort of always wanted to write a story that I think he might say. I mean, this is my story, but it really starts out from the point of view of a 90-year-old guy in a facility who his daughter finally gets him to open up about. And so that's sort of who the figure is in this story as they go back in time.
So this is personal.
Yeah, it's personal.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah.
That's awesome. Well, we're totally running out of time. Okay. I could talk to you for hours. I kid you not. I mean, it's just the energy coming from you. I thought you were wonderful on stage yesterday. You had everybody in the palm of your hand. You really did. It was wonderful.
Thanks. Thank you.
Why don't you tell people your website where they can go to find you online?
AndrewGrossBooks.com. Mm-hmm. And I mean, if you like suspenseful books and you like reading about Colorado, One Mile Under, I promise it'll grip you. You won't put it down.
It sounds like it. Yeah.
Well, thanks very much.
No problem. And do you do social media at all?
Yeah. I mean, I'm on Facebook. We all are. You can always find me. I have a friend page and then a fan page, so I'm easy to find. I don't do Twitter. I sort of think Twitter's for twits, you know. I don't know. You know, it's just, I don't think it really has a strong impact in terms of book selling, so I really don't do it. I mean, I'm on there. You can get me, but I'm usually a week late and even checking it. But so I'm basically a Facebook guy.
Okay. And do you do any kind of conventions where fans can come up and get you to sign a book or something?
Yeah, well, I'm here, you know, sure. But that's, of course, ending. I do several in the course of the year, and the big one for me is something called Thriller Fest in New York. And mm-hmm. if there are thriller writers out there, aspiring thriller writers, and it's really, I mean, everyone in the industry is there. So there's access, not just to like one thriller writer, you know, who might be in New York. I mean, I don't even rate at this place, you know. It's you've got all the very, very top, you know, Lee Child or Patterson or Nelson DeMille, you know, and Michael Connelly. So, you know, it's all the top names and you get good access to them. So.
Wonderful. Well, I'm so glad I got the chance to meet you, and thank you for coming on the show.
You bet. Thanks a lot.
And we're back. Well, hope you enjoyed that. For me this week, you could just check out my website, johnanilio.com, for some new music. And you can follow me on Twitter at johnanilio. Patrick, how about you?
John, I just wanted to tell you that when you were talking about the shows that you were watching and you mentioned Farscape and then you started talking about Dollhouse, the entire time you were talking in my head was the Farscape theme song.
It's very catchy and very unusual.
And, so it, yes, and I mean, it just, it brought it right to mind immediately. And I could not remember the Dollhouse theme, but the Farscape theme, boom, oh, in my head.
The Dollhouse theme is sung. It's by Jonathan Brook, who's actually a singer-songwriter who I like a lot. It's like, da-da-da-da-da.
Yeah.
Da-da. That's kind of creepy, too. But Farscape is one of those shows where I there's so many shows that I kind of want to watch that I haven't watched, and Farscape is sitting there on Netflix. I'm like, I could rewatch that, too. Mm-hmm. That's good.
But I know we had to get into the interview and stuff. I did have one other question for you before I get into my stuff this week. And I know we're trying to wrap this up because it's been a long episode. But when you're looking at Netflix, have you looked at that Sense8 yet?
It's in my queue.
It's in my queue too.
I just tweeted last night.
I don't know.
I was like, who's seen this? Because I've read some sort of mixed reviews on it. And I kind of want to get the overall feeling from people, like, is this worth the time? Because obviously it's the Wachowskis and
J. Michael Straczynski.
Straczynski,
Babylon 5.
Right, and I know that's one of your favorites. Oh, so yes. So a couple of people got back to me and they're like, it's great. It's weird. It's weird. It's intense. A little hard to follow, but it's great. So I think some people haven't liked it, but I've heard a lot of positive things about it now too. So, and I think they're really creatively making it a Netflix show. Meaning like if you just watched an individual episode, it would just be totally bizarre, but they're really letting themselves kind of develop it and knowing that people are going to watch it. They're going to binge watch it. They're going to watch an episode a day or watch a bunch in a weekend or whatever. And I think they're looking at it as an ongoing series. Like, yeah, boom, we're going to do this. And then we're going to do. So I'm going to check it out. Absolutely. Whether I like it and make it through it, we'll see. But I suspect the quality is high enough. I think when one of the lead actors was from Stargate Universe, the I played Matt on the show. I don't know what the actor's name is. But again, that always draws me in. It's like, I know that face.
You know,
I like the show.
You know, I was a binge watcher before binge watching was cool.
Yeah, you used to do it with DVDs.
I would buy an entire season of a DVD and I would watch it in a weekend, right? So mm-hmm. if you're looking at 22 episodes of like an hour long drama, I would watch them in a weekend. I would just have them on. I would be doing stuff around the house or I'd be writing, but I would still have like it on. Mm-hmm. And so it's interesting to me now that that has become part of our culture, that people are doing that. It's like what makes Netflix Netflix for a lot of people. Right.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's the norm now.
I think. And so to all those people who were making fun of me or telling me that I was stupid or anything like that back in those days, I just want to flip you off.
Well, that's seems like a positive way. what do you want to tell people about, though? As you give them the finger, screw you, but go read my book reviews.
That's the usual stuff. You know, I've got graphic novel reviews over at Kirkus. I do the SF Signal podcast over at sfsignal.com. And you can find me at ATFMB. That's where I am on Twitter. It's Facebook. It's everywhere. That's my website. Just go check me out there.
Cool. All right, everybody. Have a great week, and we'll see you next time.
Here? It's over. Go home. Go.
Would you like a chili, baby?